Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens here, where we live, learn, work, and play. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll talk education with one of the candidates seeking to become the next superintendent of public instruction in California, Marshall Tuck. He calls himself an education reformer. We'll find out what he thinks about things like teacher tenure, Common Core, and changes to the way that schools get their money here in the Golden State. We'll also talk about something people have called drought shaming. Maybe it's that comment you made to your neighbor about how their sprinklers are wasting water. Or maybe it's that comment about the other neighbor who's letting their lawn go dry. The resentment can go both ways, and it's starting to heat up here in California's drought. That and a talk about California's next oil boom. And no, it's not black gold. This one could be very tasty. We'll find out what it has to do about the drought and Valley farmers. But first, a few weeks ago we took you to the old Castle Air Force Base in Merced County. Their retired hangars have been transformed into a haven for tech companies, from small operations testing rockets and remotely controlled drones to one of the biggest tech companies in the world, Google, which has selected the site as its test location for its balloon-based internet system and for its much-vaunted self-driving car. But the San Joaquin Valley's quiet boom in technology-related developments isn't limited to Atwater. In fact, it's all over the valley. This week, FM89's Ezra David Romero takes us to Fresno, where a thriving software community is beginning to build on the valley's strengths and challenge stereotypes.
Just over a year ago, a ragtag team of 20-somethings in Fresno got tired of meeting in bars and coffee shops to design websites, write code, and dream of a thriving tech community in the valley.
There's a lot of stuff already happening, but why isn't it in one place?
So they decided to build their very own tech empire. But not in Silicon Valley or anywhere near the Bay.
We can pull this off in a place like Fresno, and it's not going to take anything really more than a ton of hard work and some, skills, some developer skills.
That's Irma Olguin, one of the founders of Bitwise Industries in downtown Fresno. Let's face it, Central California isn't Silicon Valley or Mountain View. The region is known for innovation when it comes to water, dairies, and tractors, not software or tech. But companies both large and small throughout the region are trying to change that. 5 years ago, Olguin created a tech conference called 59 Days of Code to challenge developers in the region to compete and show off their talent.
We either didn't have the talent or they were all busy. And so we put this competition together as sort of a way to showcase what talent was out there.
Olguin and a guy named Jake Soberall ran into each other at the competition and teamed up to create a space for techies in Fresno to be around each other. They named the creative space Bitwise Industries. In 2013, they opened their doors renting office space at tech companies and began offering coding classes. This year was the fifth year of 59 Days of Code. I showed up for the event in downtown Fresno and saw firsthand some of the software and apps created in less than 60 days. Jessa Garley is with the application Pantry Chef.
So our app, it is a pantry list, a recipe list, and a grocery list all in one. So what you do is you have all your items that's in your pantry and fridge put into the app, and the app will actually design recipes using your items.
But this is the last year the competition will be held. Soberall and Olguin say it's no longer needed.
It was designed to prove that there was technological talent in Fresno, and it did that. But what the board of directors realized is that now we're putting on an event and not causing an innovative result.
Basically, he thinks 59 Days of Code has done its job by bringing technologically inclined people together. Today, 28 companies are housed at Bitwise, and over 700 people have taken courses there.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
In a 9-foot by 10-foot room at Bitwise, cramped with 3 workstations, a couch, and dry erase everything, a company called Career Pillar has found a home. Edgar Blunt is one of the founders of the company. He's created an online interactive resource for job tutorials, like this one in Spanish.
Veamos a la entrevista de un candidato diciendo todo.
Blunt spent over 20 years as a job recruiter. He says he could have landed his company in Silicon Valley easily, but ignored offers and chose to develop in Fresno. You've picked Fresno as kind of like your launching pad or this place called home. Why Fresno?
I feel Fresno is a great place to find talent that is being underutilized.
We're excited about being part of something that could help change the landscape.
But Career Pillar is just one of many companies that have decided to stake claim in Fresno, like marketing research company Decipher.
We chose Fresno because access to talent is paramount for our ongoing success. Given that Fresno does not have a lot of technology companies, or at least hasn't historically, provided us unfettered access to really Fresno's best.
That's Jamin Brazil, one of the co-founders of Decipher. Today, the company's research and real-time survey performance software is used by companies like Facebook, Visa, and eBay. Brazil says Decipher's presence in Fresno is part of the changing tech scene in the region.
There's a perception that if you want to be in technology as a person starting your career, you need to move out of this area. Now graduates or pre-graduates say, I have these options available to me either now or in my near future.
Back in downtown Fresno, there's talk of expansion.
We are in what will become the Wise South Stadium. It will be the next evolution of what you saw at Bitwise Mural District.
At one time, the 52,000 square foot building was a three-story indoor car dealership. Once again, Jake Soberall.
When you walk in the door about 8 to 10 months from now, what you'll see is a reception desk, and you'll see polished concrete floors, very modern white walls, you'll see lots of glass. And then to your right and all the way down the backside of the building, you're going to see technology companies of all stripes.
But Soberall says what he and his team are creating won't be like Silicon Valley or San Francisco, because they can't be.
We're Fresno, and we should be Fresno. And to the extent that we keep trying to replicate other places, we will fail.
In less than a year, Bitwise hopes to open the door even wider to technological innovation in the region. Reporting from downtown Fresno, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The numbers are in, and despite constant warnings about California's drought, people across the state are actually using more water this year than last. Angst over water is nothing new around these parts, but usually it's involving farmers complaining about environmentalists or vice versa. But this year, it's often neighbor against neighbor as residents seek to conserve water, turning off the sprinklers and letting yards go brown. The result is sometimes resentment. One neighbor complains about the other's leaky sprinklers or about the unsightly landscaping, even posting pictures to social media calling out the offending party. It's been dubbed drought shaming, and it's our topic this hour on Valley Edition. Joining us now, we have freelance journalist and community college professor Jefferson Beavers, who has written about this issue on his blog. Jefferson, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
And Mark Standriff. He's a spokesperson for the city of Fresno, which has instituted new outdoor watering restrictions effective this Friday. Mark, welcome.
It's great to be on, Joe. Thanks.
Jefferson, I want to start with you. What's the conversation been like in your Fresno neighborhood? Do you have neighbors who are looking afoul of their fellow neighbors and their sprinklers or their lawns?
I think that my neighborhood is it's in East Central Fresno. It's a kind of working class neighborhood, and it's probably like a microcosm of what you would see anywhere else in the state. There's about maybe a third of the neighbors who've let their lawns go brown. The rest of them are still watering business as usual. And I think that my wife and I have been among the first to kind of let our sprinklers die and our lawn go brown. It's been about 3 years now. And we've faced a lot of shaming for letting our lawns go brown. But now, of course, it's the tide is turning and folks are, you know, calling out folks who are maybe overwatering.
How is that shaming materialized? What's that like?
It's just a lot of small comments like, that's what you're doing with your lawn, or I noticed that there's this dirt over here. It's pretty dusty out here these days, and you know it's usually pretty indirect. But now I think it's again that tide's turning where you know you see the perfectly green putting greens, and you kind of wonder, hey, that's an awful lot of water you're using over there.
Do you think this? Speaks to the often prickly relationship neighbors can sometimes have, and
sure.
Is this making that worse in any way?
I think it is. One of the things that about you know just calling it drought shaming is it really does pit a person against person, and I think that's the big downside to it. I think the more perhaps the more progressive way to think about it would be to start to reimagine what our green spaces look like. There's lots of drought-tolerant, water-wise plants that are available. If there was perhaps some more assistance, especially in poorer and working-class neighborhoods, to help convert those lawns, I think that would be a much more constructive conversation to be having, rather than, hey, let's call in so-and-so down the block for watering their sidewalk.
And this has been something that people have been talking about statewide, turning to online and our Twitter followers. We got a tweet from Danielle in Fresno. She said, my neighbors are actually, she said, anyone else getting drought shame for not watering their lawn enough? My neighbor gave us grief for our yellowish lawn. My neighbor said reducing watering doesn't make much difference for conservation. Mark, turning to you now, the city of Fresno introduced new restrictions on outdoor residential watering last week. They take effect Friday. What are those restrictions and why is the city making those moves?
Well, and I think the most important thing for everybody to understand is that the city of Fresno has been a leader in water conservation for 20 years. Back in 1994, we instituted really the first imposed restrictions in the state. In fact, we got a little bit of ridicule for it. They felt like we were getting a little too defensive about our water situation. That's when we went to 3 days a week watering. So the new plan that's in place that starts on Friday is actually the only change is you're losing a day of watering. So it goes from instead of 3 days a week, 2 days a week. So if you have an address that's odd numbered, it's Tuesdays and Saturdays. Even numbered, it's Wednesdays and Sundays. No watering, obviously, Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays. But all the other restrictions, including the hours, like after 6 before 7 a.m., other things like a series of warnings are fine, still the same thing that we've been doing for the last 20 years.
So what is the enforcement part of this? How does that work? Is there an ramped-up enforcement effort, and how do you have neighbors calling in other neighbors, reporting them to the city water cops, or is there somebody driving around looking for sprinklers that are going on the wrong day on the wrong side of the street?
Well, I certainly want to thank the Fresno Bee for coining the phrase water cops, because that's not really what our conservation representatives are all about. Yes, are they part of enforcement? Absolutely. But for the most part, what they're doing is, and these are folks that they're on a schedule that actually goes 7 days a week, because you know, water is obviously the lifeblood of our valley, and we want to make sure that people out there are not only aware of possible overwatering issues, but are also aware of the potential for them to learn more about. And this goes back to what Jefferson was saying about different neighborhoods understanding that there are, you know, more plants that are more indigenous to the Central Valley that might be more drought resistant, rather than using the typical kind of Midwest or East Coast horticultural plan, grasses that are a little hardier. And these are folks that know everything about that and can go to your house and say, okay, you know, we've gotten a complaint from somebody. And again, they remain anonymous. But from that standpoint, you know, we understand that you might be watering a little bit. Do you understand? Do you have problems with your irrigation system? So they can actually, you know, they can help you program if you're having problems with your individual system as well, replacing broken sprinkler heads. They'll even go out there and start working with commercial and industrial firms too to talk about some of the technology that's out there to be able to go smarter. You know, the interesting thing, and I'm sorry if I go on, but the interesting thing that we're finding in this whole drought shaming thing is that a lot of places like golf courses and cemeteries are getting a lot of negative attention for having green fields and fairways. And yet they're stuck in kind of a no-win situation because the people that frequent those places want to see green, especially around, let's say, Grandma Doris's gravesite. So letting that go brown isn't necessarily an option for them. But you'll find that the people who are in charge of those things are probably the most frugal and the most interested parties when it comes to how much they're actually spending to the water. They'll tell you down to the drop how much they're spending. So they're being conscious about it, but I think everybody's just got to be responsible.
I should say that these restrictions are unique to Fresno, but they are not entirely unique because statewide cities have been required to step up their enforcement to this level 2 in Bakersfield. Our listeners there know that the city made a decision last week to close down 9 splash parks early for the summer. They'll close this week, I believe. And the cities throughout the valley are doing this. Is the city of Fresno doing the $500 fines that the state is?
No. And then, unfortunately, people tended to overreact when they heard $500. They thought it was like an automatic ticket if somebody catches you, you know, hosing down your driveway or washing your car, you know, in a big block party. Our fine system is set up so that you get a warning the first time. After that, it's more consultation and a $45 fine. That can continue on for four more $45 fines until the city actually has the option to shut off water. Let me just tell you, though, that's only in extreme circumstances. And when I say extreme, let me tell you about the last time the city of Fresno actually shut off somebody's water. It was a gentleman who was absolutely adamant about building a moat around his house. So you really have to go way, way out there. But again, what we're trying to do is we're not out there trying to be water cops. The city of Fresno is out there to try to help people understand that you don't necessarily – watering two days a week doesn't have to be a death sentence for your lawn. If we can help you find ways to irrigate smarter and better, if we can give you opportunities to figure out how your system works and how it can work in conjunction with your neighbors, and more importantly, what other options are out there for you rather than imposing a bunch of fines and seeming like a bunch of brown shirts.
I want to turn now to another guest we have on the phone with us, Felicia Marcus. She's from the State Water Resources Control Board. Felicia, how are communities throughout the state dealing with this? Is there a great variety or difference in ways that communities are dealing with this problem?
Oh, it's as varied as the state. I mean, you have some communities that have gone so far as to do landscape ordinances that essentially are saying that their climate's not appropriate really for Midwestern lawns. That would be at one end of the spectrum. There are others who have gone to very aggressive rate structures or what are called allocation-based rates, where they've said, here's the average or the reasonable amount of water that a given household, you know, depending on how many people you have, should need, and here's what's reasonable for your landscaping. And if you use more, the rates go up dramatically. You have a variety of outdoor and indoor irrigation, or indoor use and outdoor irrigation rules. Some communities have been aggressively using rebates as well as regulation over the past 20 years to get toilet retrofits and appliance upgrades, et cetera, or even in Los Angeles and other Southern California communities, there are pretty aggressive turf buyout programs so they can help ease the cost of redoing one's yard to a drought-tolerant yard. So it really varies.
What would be the next step beyond the beyond the rules that the Water Resources Board implemented earlier this month? What would be the next step? Was it stage three, and how much more draconian would that be?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we're hoping these rules just take effect. I think they took effect yesterday afternoon, which was a few days sooner than we thought. And the goal of these was really to ring the bell and get communities that hadn't yet stepped up to mandatory outdoor irrigation to do so. There was a lot of focus on the fines, as Mark said, as if immediately you got a $500 ticket. That was a tool in the toolkit, and the progressive education approach is something that we think is a good idea as well. But the piece that people missed was that having agencies upgrade their drought contingency plans, implement the ones that had some kind of mandatory outdoor irrigation, or there's a $10,000 fine per day for agencies. So our target was getting the agencies to step up more than individuals, but we thought the individual norms were important as well, just to get it across to people that we were in a drought. In many respects, our target was much of urban California that's hundreds of miles away from their water source, and they wouldn't have known there was a drought. So part of it was to say, hey, guys, it's time to step up. We're all in this together. You have fields going fallow in the Central Valley. You have communities that are running out of water. The least you could do is not overwater your lawn. Now, we're hoping that this is going to yield a lot of progress. And so far, anecdotally, we've gotten a lot of folks who had been resistant agencies saying, okay, we're going to step up. They've set their meetings or they've already had their meetings to implement their stage, whatever stage it is for them. The PPIC poll came in saying that 75% of Californians want mandatory conservation at the local level. So between our regs and community opinion, we're hoping it's going to be easier for those agencies to step up and take action, and so maybe we won't have to go to the next level. If we go to the next level, it's not just saying stage three. It's any number of things. We may declare certain uses unreasonable in a drought. We might get folks to focus more on leaks. And there's a whole host of other things we might go to.
Certainly.
But we're trying to get those things that would be communicate to people they needed to act, but not force people to spend a lot of money or do something outside the norm of what many agencies are already doing.
Thank you so much, Felicia. Jefferson, I want to turn back to you because you posted about this issue of drought shaming last week on your blog. Mm-hmm. And in your case, you were not talking about your neighbors. You were talking about the city of Fresno and Cary Park, which is near your home on Augusta Avenue, right behind Fashion Fair. What did you see?
Basically, this summer, as I've been walking early mornings, super early, 5 a.m. before dawn, I'd noticed that the park was getting watered pretty much every day for close to a full hour on weekdays. And that was resulting in, puddling in the actual park itself. There's some sprinkler heads that were spraying into the street. One sprinkler head in particular was busted. And so, I had kind of just accepted this as a fact of life in our neighborhood. This park has always been a super lush green park. Of course, it serves a wide range of people in that area. As Mark mentioned, people expect those types of spaces to be green. But when the Stage 2 announcement came out, I thought, well, maybe this is a time that I need to speak up and say something about that and not just accept it as, business as usual. And so at this point, that's when I produced several posts last week, two this week and one this, about some photographs and a video showing the actual watering of the street, puddling, what I think is really overwatering. And again, my whole thinking was, I don't really believe that drought shaming is a solution to this. I think you're a neighbor, you should go talk with your neighbor. But at the same time, if the city is asking us to enact these kinds of things, then it should be taking the lead in making those kinds of re-envisionings and specific adjustments themselves.
Mark, do the new restrictions apply to the city itself?
Absolutely. In fact, the city of Fresno is either the number one or the number two water user, depending on the time of year. And just getting back to, what Jefferson's blog and his posts on social media, from my standpoint, I'm the person who's in charge of kind of monitoring what's going on. I happened to see his Twitter post on the issue, contacted him directly, went out and just let the folks in Public Works know that there was an issue on Cary Park. We thought we had it taken care of, but Cary again, Jefferson again stepped forward and said that, the leak seems to be back. So now I've got to reach out to Public Works again this morning and let them know it, because it seems that the problem is a little bit more than just some sort of a surface fix. But let me get to the whole thing about drought shaming and certainly about the city of Fresno being leading by example. From the very moment that the State Water Resources Control Board made their announcement, we were out there and trying to let people know that, it's important for us to know when issues like this are happening. If you're seeing a sprinkler shooting straight up in the air, if you're seeing a leaky, sidewalk concrete fixture, if you're seeing puddles showing up or we're irrigation dripping bare strips of dirt, you need to let us know. And it's probably just as important to let us know as directly as you can, as quickly as you can, so we can get the problem fixed.
And you have a city hotline. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, even with neighbors. Do you talk to your neighbor about the problem, or do you post something on social media saying, hey, the person two doors down has got the sprinkler going? You chose to blog about this.
That's right.
Did you call 621 City and report this first? Or
the initial call, I did call the city, and it seemed like a little bit of a confusing maze to get through. Now, there's another number that's been put out in recent days that, it's a more specific number. I don't know where that number goes to, but the main city number to me is a little confusing. I know it's meant to be a one-stop shop, but just as a resident, one try in that felt confusing. And so then I said, well, I don't know if I have the patience to go through this, this phone tree and series of messages. So that's when I took to Twitter.
And the 621 City line, as Jefferson mentioned, is a one-call shop. These are folks that have, big pages of FAQs that they want to need to go through.
Sure.
That's why we established a line, 621-5380. That's the direct line that goes right to our water conservation department, lets us know where those problems are. They immediately notify Public Works. And then, of course, the issue is the city of Fresno has over 1,300 irrigation systems, that we've got to try to monitor it. And again, that's why it's important. The issue of drought shaming, and specifically on social media, I don't know if you gentlemen agree with this, but there's also a certain amount of self-indulgence that kind of goes with people kind of, throwing things out on Twitter or Instagram or whatever and hoping that the world sees it. Fortunately, you get the right set of eyes on it, especially when the city's involved, and we can take care of those things. But our feeling is always we need to lead by example. So, we're urging people out there, if you're going to narc on anybody, narc on the city.
Well, it's very interesting indeed, and we'll certainly be following this as it continues. We certainly hope the weather turns around and we have another wet year, but as Jefferson said, maybe it's time to look at more drought-friendly landscaping throughout the city. Again, Mark Stander, spokesperson for the city of Fresno, and Jefferson Beavers, a journalist and blogger online. He's been blogging about drought shaming online. Jefferson, your website again?
JeffersonBeavers.com.
And Mark, that number one more time?
It's 621-5480.
All right. Thank you both so much for joining us. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about California's next oil boom. It might be a tasty one. Coming up next on Valley Edition.
California Chrome, the colt from Kalinga that won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, was a $10,000 investment that earned his owners $20 million. Now's your chance to run for the roses. Your $60 investment could earn you $10,000 in Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. More information and a downloadable entry form are available at kvpr.org.
And it's a run for the roses, as fast as you can.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, stories of escape.
It's already limited over there for youth. So imagine a youth without papers in Oakland, you know what I mean?
A young immigrant escapes the cycle of crime and dashed hopes through music. That's next time on Latino USA.
Thursday night at 8 on Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We all know Central California produces most of the state's petroleum, but could another oil boom be on the horizon? Well, that's what journalist Nathaniel Johnson from the online environmental news website Grist argues in a new article that came out last week. But he's not talking about fracking or the Monterey Shale. He's talking about olive oil. He joins us now on Valley Edition. Nathaniel Johnson, welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
Essentially, what you're arguing is that the drought, consumer trends, and some less than scrupulous practices by foreign olive oil importers could, in your view, drive California growers to turn to olives. Why is that?
Well, all those things that you just mentioned. I think the main issue is that olive trees are really good in the kind of climate that we have in the Central Valley. You know, they're a Mediterranean tree. They're built for low water situations. They have these small waxy leaves that resist water transpiration, and they can go dormant when it gets really dry. In most places around the world, they're grown without any irrigation at all. And So farmers all over are starting to put in olive trees in land that they thought was just completely unusable. And so there's the possibility to grow it. And there's also, it seems like people are waking up to the possibility of eating more of it. So there's a market growing out there.
Yes, indeed. And we're joined also in our studio by Robert Rocha. He's from Enzo Olive Oil, a local artisanal olive oil producer from Madera County. Robert, welcome.
Thank you, and good morning.
And now olives are certainly a crop that's been grown here in the San Joaquin Valley for well over 100 years.
That's correct.
Your family has been in, or the family company has been involved with olives for years. What do you see as the outlook for local olive oil producers? Is this something that is picking up steam? Because it's kind of had ups and downs. We had the Lindsay olives. That was a big thing.
Right.
And I remember Al Radka and the Oberti olive commercial in Madera years ago. But it kind of seems like it went away for a while, but now the olive oil industry is coming back, I guess.
When you look at the olive production in California, there's been a major shift out of the fresh olives into the planting the varieties for olive oil. So adapting, what we're talking about here is adapting, right, to conditions that we have now, which is the drought and less water to deal with. So farmers now, and that's why the Ricciuti family decided to go into planting the olives a few years back and getting production, it's making that change out of certain crops into others that takes less water, like Nathaniel brought up. So when we decided, it was a couple reasons. The need, we saw the need for a good extra virgin oil in the market that we know that's not there right now on the grocery shelves. And we know there needs to be more of that production. And that's what we decided to plant enough and go organic as well. But yeah, definitely it was a decision we made both because of adapting, making changes, and also it's labor. Fresh olives takes a lot of labor to pick the olives. When you get to our production now and we set up with a super high density train, then you can mechanically harvest. Big difference in cost.
There's a lot of talk this year about the way water is used in the state. Almonds are the big cash crop right now. You see, even in the middle of the drought, almond orchards going in right now because the profits are absolutely huge and the demand keeps growing and growing and growing. How do your trees deal with drought? Because almonds take a fair bit
and
of water.
Our biggest commodity is almonds. So our biggest commodity, and I'm glad Nathaniel put that in his article there about loving almonds, and thank you. So because almonds are healthy. They're good. And that's what continues to grow worldwide, the demand for almonds. And so that's a good thing. But they do take more water. And like it says in the article, it is about twice as much water that they do take. So and almonds cannot go without the water, right? So olive trees can go into dormancy. So they can shut down and they can get through those periods and then kind of come back out of it. Now, almonds, no. So what's happening now is there's definitely, as people are running out of water, don't have the surface water, they're looking at what items to be able to grow. That's where I see they're going to be looking at pistachios has been one, and I believe olives will be another. But we have to make the change in the marketplace because people just don't know about a good extra virgin olive oil, and they're still using this. The stuff that's on the shelf that is not good, has no taste, and not good for them. So the education at the consumer level needs to take place. We've got a long ways to go, but we actually have entities that just got established too that's going to help in regards to that, standards and creating demand.
Turning back to you, Nathaniel, that is a big part of this because if you have farmers who can make a lot more money growing almonds, they're probably going to do that. Olive oil demand is up, but on the consumer level, there's some interesting things that are going on there. You talk about it briefly in your piece and mention there's a book, Extra Virgin, that talks about this very interesting and odd world of what exactly is in your olive oil, especially with some of the things that are imported from outside the country. What is the problem there?
Well, the problem is that we're suckers, basically. In the U.S., we get the world's olive oil that's rejected from other places, and unless you're getting locally grown olive oil, you're often getting the bad stuff. So, and we just haven't. It's not so much part of our culture, so we don't know what good olive oil tastes like. And many people in the United States have never tasted this stuff.
That's right.
Because we're always getting the stuff that the Italians don't want or the Spanish don't want, and much of it is mislabeled and or rancid. So there's all kinds of unscrupulous practices. You know, people bringing in shipments fraudulently. You know, you have these worldwide supply chains, and every stop along the way, there's the possibility of someone to make a little buck by slipping in some soy oil or you know something like that. This is an industry that, at least historically, has really been beset by a lot of fraud. But I'd be interested to hear. I don't know about the changes, and it sounds like Robert, there's some more information that I don't have about the future on that.
Yeah, what's the latest on that, Robert?
Looking better, much better. We are currently right now establishing the standards for California olive oil, which is important to do once we get that set, and the commission has been established for California. And we have people on the board, and we're setting the standards. And because we have the highest levels of standards, California does. And we have a seal. We send our oils in. They get tested, and they're certified extra virgin. So, you know, for the listeners out there, it's important to look at that seal.
And what does that mean? What does extra virgin mean?
Well, that's a great point, Joy, because it is important. And in itself, quickly, is extra virgin is the highest grade of olive oil, can be received. It's free of defects or taste flaws and produced without chemicals or extreme heat, okay? So just know this. A lot of the world cannot produce extra virgin oil because you have to have the right equipment. It has to be milled within hours, so much time that when it's picked, and it can't be damaged. So there's a lot that goes into it. So the investment is high. You take a look at Europe, for instance. The locations of the orchards, getting it to the mill where it gets milled, it can be days. They get behind. They can't keep up. That all affects the quality. So we, as California, we produce, we go for the quality. We go for the top quality, which is extra virgin, which is important, right? We want the consumer to have a top quality. But that definition in itself, and when Nathaniel's talking about, it's just a blatant misrepresentation at the shelf. And it's so wrong. But nobody's really doing anything about it.
The FDA doesn't do anything?
Or? No. But believe me, Pat has been to D.C. with a lot of the other producers, okay? And we're working in Sacramento. We are setting – but we have a battle. It's a David and Goliath deal. There's no doubt about it. These guys are big. It's big money for them. They've had this market. It's a dumping ground is what it is, okay, because nobody's changing it. We are definitely want to change that, and that's going to be the one of the secrets for our success is getting it marked right, getting people familiar. So I definitely challenge your listeners out there, go out, taste the fresh oil. There's a few places in Fresno and Clovis, Bella Fruta we sample every day. You can go to Sarah Nut House, Wee Olives in Fig Garden. Go out there, taste it, know what it is, because what we need is you. We need you to demand good olive oil in the restaurants, and Nathaniel brought out in his article, because the restaurants, I think yet to be in a restaurant that serves a good olive oil. So it's important. So getting familiar with it, know what it is, and getting it demanded from the consumer is going to leave that other oil off, leave it on the shelf. Well, it's not going to be sold.
And as Nathaniel says, it could have benefits for California, and not only for producers, but for the entire Central Valley. Again, Nathaniel Johnson from the online magazine Grist. You can read his article about California's next oil boom online at grist.org. And also joining us today, Robert Rocha of Enzo Olive Oil, a local artisanal olive oil producer from Madera County. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. The middle of summer is often considered something of a slow news time. A lot of politicians go on vacation, and things generally slow down a little bit in late July and early August. But in the world of education, the summer of 2014 has been anything but quiet. Not only are teachers getting ready to go back into the classroom, several hot-button issues have sparked a national debate, from the future of teacher tenure to the new Common Core curriculum. Education is all over the news. And in just a few months, California voters will get a chance to select the next head of the state's K-12 school system. Today, we get to talk to one of those candidates. Joining us now in our studio is Marshall Tuck, candidate for the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction. Welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me, Joe. I appreciate it.
You come to this race with a background in education, in turning around schools, leading in Southern California the Partnership for LA Schools as an education reformer. That's your brand, so to speak. What did you learn from that process working with Mayor Villaraigosa and others in Southern California in those 17 schools?
Yeah, as you mentioned, Joe, my background, I spent over a decade leading two different school systems in LA. One was Green Dot Public Schools, which opened a number of charter high schools in the toughest need areas of LA. And then secondly, working with former Mayor Villaraigosa, where we took over the lowest performing traditional public schools. A couple things. One is you're always encouraged and reinforced by what's possible for our kids if we really give them a quality education. Because we went into some of the toughest schools in LA. Give you an example, Jordan High School was the lowest performing high school in Los Angeles. What lowest performing means is there were 20 students out of 1,000 that were grade level in mathematics when we first got there. And a school that really the system had let had let down kids for a couple of decades. And so we took those schools over. We saw significant success. We had the highest improvement at the partnership schools of any school system in the state, with more than 10,000 kids on the state exams. And we moved our graduation rates up by 60%. So I clearly saw what's possible. But I also experienced really on a regular basis how difficult it is for teachers and parents and principals to run schools and educate kids because of the lack of leadership in Sacramento and because of what's really a broken bureaucratic education code that makes it very difficult for educators on the ground in local communities to do the very best for their children.
So exactly what did you do that made the difference with those schools? Was this a charter operation? How did that work?
You know,
this is a nonprofit organization.
Yeah, I mean, the good news about schools is the formula for public schools is pretty consistent. And so let's talk about it. I mentioned Jordan High School. Let's talk about it. First and foremost, we brought in a really strong school leader because you need to have Sherry Williams is a woman who just brought the school to life, believed in her kids, and was really good at helping her teachers get better. Secondly, we made sure that we had effective teachers in every classroom. And that was the teachers that, one, first and foremost, believed in our kids. Two, that were able to have the skills to be successful. And three, frankly, we were making sure that they had more time because our teachers needed support. And we actually invested a lot of money in teacher training, teacher development. We found our best teachers that helped their peers get be more successful. We brought technology to our schools. We made sure kids had the right courses. And we invested a lot in parent engagement. We actually ran a parent college, Joe, on Saturdays where we actually would teach our parents how to get more involved and their kids' education because, in Watts and East L.A., which are really challenging communities, we had a lot of single-family households, a lot of foster parents, a lot of parents that were new to this country, but they still love their kids. And so we actually invested heavily in getting our parents more involved in our schools. And that's the formula that you see in most public schools. And again, it worked. In the case of Jordan, it went from literally the lowest performing high school to the following year, it was the highest improving high school in the state of California. It just shows you what's possible for our kids if we do what's right by them.
There's some people who say charters are great, they have their role, but it's not the replacement for the traditional model that we have throughout the state. What do you say to that?
Well, what's unique about my background is I led a charter school organization, which is Green Dot Public Schools, but the partnership weren't charters. They were traditional public schools. And I think there's too much time spent on kind of this either or, either charters or traditional public schools. And we need to all focus on what makes the most sense for kids. What is the fundamental change that we need to make in our schools in the state so that if we know that charters have more flexibility and that helps them educate kids more effectively, let's give more flexibility to traditional public schools and local school communities. Because right now, your traditional public schools, and I lived it because I led them, are constrained by a lot of the challenges in Sacramento. So I think that we need to kind of get over this back and forth dialogue and focus on what parents care about. A safe, high-quality school in their neighborhood that's public. That's what a parent wants regardless of governing structure. And we need the leadership to get focused on delivering that.
Even when you move beyond politics, when you talk to teachers, there's always in many cases, I should say, a certain tension between classroom teachers and administrators. The refrain you often hear is teachers say, there's too many administrators. All they do is have new rules for us, and they're out of touch with the classroom. You don't have experience in the classroom as an instructor. Do you think that it changes the formula by having classroom instruction experience in an administrator position, or maybe it's more about organizational leadership and things like that that are different from the classroom experience? What are your thoughts?
I certainly think for principals, you need to have classroom experience because your main job as a principal is to help develop your teachers. I mean, principals, first and foremost, are instructional leaders. And so it's important that principals have that experience in classroom. I've spent the last 12 years. I've been in classrooms nonstop for 12 years. I actually do have a small amount of teaching experience, not for extended period of time, where I was in a classroom with a load of kids for a little less than a year. But I've been running schools and turning them around for the last 12 years. I think the key we got to push to is what you alluded to, which is when you have principals and teachers on the same page working together, that's when you have a functional school. And I've never actually come to an effective school that was doing well where you had a lot of tension and conflict between teachers and principals. It's frankly in our schools that are less effective is where you see that conflict. And that's a conflict that's not good for children. There's always going to be some you know, tension naturally between, let's call it, management and employees. But usually it's a respectful, healthy, focused relationship. And that's what you see in high-quality public schools. And I think far too often there are folks at play, you know, both in Sacramento and beyond that lead to this tension, which is just not good for kids. And it has to change, because you can ask any teacher, they would love to have a high-quality principal that knows instruction. And yes, principals, they want teachers who want to get better. And in teachers' defense, like when we took our schools over in LA, we had some teachers who their principal hadn't been in their classroom for a year and a half or 2 years. So, you know, how do you expect them to get better? So we got a lot of work to do there, but it has to be on the same team, and that team has to be first and foremost Team Kid.
If you just joined us in Valley Edition today, we're talking with Marshall Tuck. He is a candidate for the Office of Superintendent for Public Instruction in California in the November election, facing off against incumbent Tom Torlakson. What brought you not to this race, but what brought you to this field?
You know, I'm someone who grew up going to church on Sundays. I still do, and really a belief that in life the most important thing we can do is serve other people and help other people have a better life. And I believe strongly that there is no more important issue in our state and our country than education in terms of giving kids the future that they need. And it's an issue we are failing on right now, because there are so many children in public schools right now, they're not getting a great chance. And so, you know, at a pretty young age, I started down a traditional path that was outside of education, but I just said, you know what, I'm not waiting 40 years to do what I care about. I'm going to get focused right now on helping people have a better life, and I'm jumping into education. And we've seen a lot of success for a lot of kids over the last 12 years. But what I want to see, frankly, is success for all kids in California. And what I know quite clearly is that will not happen until we get the kind of leadership in Sacramento that truly is focused on a kids first agenda, and that really is an independent advocate for kids and parents that is pushing the fundamental changes we need in our state. Because, you know, while we're sitting here, there's 2.5 million kids in California that are going to be in public schools in a couple weeks when school starts that can't read and write at grade level. You know, it's absolutely unacceptable. It's punishing to their future. And we need to all come together and make changes. And that's, you know, that's what we did in our schools, you know, in L.A. And we certainly have a long way to go. But that's what we need to do as a state.
A few weeks ago, the Vergara decision made national news as an L.A. County Superior Court overturned the state's landmark teacher tenure law. You have asked Governor Brown not to appeal that decision. Why is that? And what do you feel the importance of that would be?
Well, I've been a strong supporter of the plaintiffs in that lawsuit. And just to give your audience, make sure everyone knows, that there's 9 students who sued the state of California, and they sued Tom Torlakson, who's my opponent in this race, as well as the governor in the state, saying that the laws that are written into our legislature and in the Ed Code that say that 2-year tenure for teachers, the fact that layoffs are only done based on seniority, and the fact that it's almost impossible to remove teachers, that those laws violate our students' constitutional right to quality education. And the reason I've been so supportive is because I ran schools. And if you've run schools, you know, like I do, that we had Markham Middle School, this most violent school in L.A., where half of our teachers received layoff notices because more senior teachers didn't want to go to work at Markham. So we had all young teachers. And because seniority is just based on layoffs, half our teachers were going to get layoff notices. And in that case, we also sued. A student of ours actually decided to sue the state. So I was a strong believer in the lawsuit. And I believe that the state superintendent should have been on the side of the plaintiffs, because the vast majority of people in education, the vast majority of the public know that those laws that make it more difficult to have an effective teacher in every classroom, they don't make sense for kids, and we need change. And fortunately, the judge literally said that these laws are unconstitutional. The judge said the evidence shocks the conscience is really what he said in his quote in the decision. And it's absolutely time for the current superintendent in the state to not appeal this case, and let's move forward and let's make changes to these laws that truly are focused on what it takes to give kids a good education.
The other hot issue, or one of the other hot issues right now in the world of education, both in California and beyond, is Common Core. It's become sort of a political lightning rod for many critics who say it's a federal takeover education. But beyond that political narrative, you talk to teachers, and I see them split into two different camps. Some who feel it's very good, maybe has some flaws here, but they welcome it after the No Child Left Behind era. There's another group of teachers who have concerns not so much about the politics behind it, but about what it really means in the classroom, and this massive shift between the sort of the quantitative model under Common Core and now this new approach that's very much focused on process. And they say things like, why is history and social science sublimated under English language skills? You know, some teachers may teach things like the Constitution and American history in English, but there's no requirement that they do. What are your thoughts on something like that? Is this the pendulum just swinging from one extreme at No Child Left Behind to another extreme that's focused very much in the opposite way, just on process, or not just on process, but more so in that way? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, Joe, I appreciate you focusing on, hey, the teacher level and the school level rather than just the political level, because I think far too often we get caught in politics versus really what does it mean for teachers and principals. I think with the Common Core, one of the reasons you see so many different opinions amongst teachers is because it's been rolled out so poorly by the state, where we literally did not give teachers any additional time for training. We did not give them significant additional support in terms of getting ready for the Common Core. And then all of a sudden last year said, okay, by the way, you're now teaching the Common Core. And the end result there, I think, as you mentioned, is you have kind of a lot of misinformation. You also have people who are struggling with this transition. And I think that the transition, first and foremost, from what typically has been our prior standards, because the state's always had standards. The prior standards were around more rote memorization. I think this is trying to move us more towards project-based, you know, kind of really critical thinking, more project-based approach towards learning and teaching is one that I think is beneficial for kids. But there's no question that you got to teach U.S. history in this state and in this country, and that there's no, you know, that doesn't get subjugated to English, because that's just the way it needs to be. And frankly, that's not a requirement. I think you're seeing a lot of people, because they did not get the appropriate training and support, are scrambling a bit. And there's just a lot of misinformation, which is playing out based on what you were saying. I think the most important thing the state can do right now, because the state's made the decision to move forward on Common Core, is let's make sure we are getting teachers more time to get better at this. It's a significant shift for teachers in their practice to move from how they were teaching before to where they need to move to. They need more time to do that. Let's inform parents about what really is going on with this transition. Let's make sure we're getting feedback from parents and teachers. And most importantly, let's make sure that local school communities realize and understand that they still have the control over the curriculum. What are you teaching and how you teach it still sits with local school districts and local schools. And let's make sure that that happens and that the state doesn't try to hold on too tight to that going forward.
Governor Brown and your opponent in November, Tom Torlakson, have been working for the past year on shifting education resources to districts where they say the need is greater, districts with populations that have more English language learners, higher poverty rates. They call this the local control funding formula. How would you critique the way that has been rolled out, and how would you approach this differently if you were in Sacramento?
I think the biggest issue on the local control funding is there's a lot of talk about what are people's plans on how to spend the money, but there's not a system in place to show where is the money actually spent and what results were driven. And I think that's what we need to make sure we move towards, which is let's give schools and school districts a lot of flexibility on how to utilize that money. I think that's essential, because the people that are closest to kids, you know, principals and teachers, should be making those decisions. But let's make sure that taxpayers can see clearly with the additional money that's going to schools, how was that spent? And did that work in terms of improving student achievement for kids? So I'm a supporter of the local control funding. I have a son, and there's no question that it's going to be less expensive to educate my child than it was to educate a lot of the kids that I work with in Watson, South LA, and East LA, just given, as you mentioned, a lot of the unique circumstances they have. So I think giving more dollars to those that need it is a good thing. But I think what the state really hasn't done is said, let's make sure that the public can see where the money goes. Which isn't that difficult to do, which is really kind of saying with the additional dollars that the taxpayers passed, let's make sure it's very transparent as to what it was spent on. And then did those dollars actually translate into results for higher graduation rates, higher attendance, you know, less violence on campus, and ultimately more student achievement? And that hasn't been done. That hasn't been the focus. I think that's something where we have to move to stronger accountability on the back end as a state. Like, my philosophy is always give local communities significant empowerment to make decisions for their kids, but then also let's have strong accountability to make sure that's working for kids. And that's the next phase that just hasn't been there on local control funding so far.
We've been talking with Marshall Tuck today on Valley Edition. He is a candidate for the office of Superintendent of Public Instruction on the November ballot, facing off against incumbent Tom Torlakson. Marshall Tuck, thank you so much for joining us today.
Joe, I appreciate you having us, and I appreciate you folks on this race. There's nothing more important to our state. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, you can find our podcast on our website, kvpr.org. You can also, when you're there, send us an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org, or follow us anytime on Twitter. We are @Valley Edition and @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens here, where we live, learn, work, and play. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.